Hello, Annabelle Quince here with an extra Rear Vision podcast for this week. As I'm sure you've probably heard on the news, a leaked draft opinion from the US Supreme Court is indicating that the court may be about to overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. It was that decision that protected a woman's right in the United States to an abortion. Overturning that decision would be a seismic shift in US politics. But have you ever wondered why the abortion debate is so polarizing in America? And what's the story behind the Roe versus Wade decision?
Protests have broken out across America, most recently in Montgomery, Alabama, where the state Senate just passed the nation's strictest anti-abortion laws. State Senator Clyde Chambliss knows his law will likely be swiftly challenged, but he welcomes the fight. He has broader aims, overturning the most famous Supreme Court ruling, Roe v. Wade.
What this bill is designed to do is to go to the Supreme Court and challenge that particular precedence.
Abortion is once again in the news in the United States, and at the center of the debate is the 1973 Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN. The Roe v. Wade decision changed the law across America, establishing that the US Constitution provided a fundamental right to privacy that protected a woman's right to an abortion. In this program, we're going to look at a time before Roe v. Wade, at how and why abortion became a crime in the United States, and how the Roe decision changed America. But first, what might surprise you is that for most of the 18th and 19th centuries, early abortions were not illegal or even controversial in the United States. Leslie Regan is Professor of History at the University of Illinois and the author of When Abortion Was a Crime.
It was legal under common law, and it was not an uncommon practice either. It was recognized at the point of quickening. Quickening is when you could feel fetal movement, feel a kick, as something that was against the law under common law. And also women themselves recognized at that point that a life had begun at the point of quickening, when they could feel movement inside. But that's the only point where it was recognized as abortion.
So what were the methods and how did they actually end a pregnancy?
People used mostly herbs like pennyroyal, cotton root, different things they might be able to find in their own gardens. There were, in the 18th century and 19th century, domestic guidebooks that told you what to grow and how to make teas and what to take to bring your menses back. Then also there were traveling traders who sold packets of herbs, and that was sort of a euphemism for doing this, was called taking the trade. So it was well enough known that there was actually a euphemism that she's taking the trade. And then also, if those things didn't work, then there were a variety of other methods that people might try, from falling downstairs or riding horses really hard or sitting in a hot bath, to then eventually trying things that are more instrumental and inserting those into their vagina and their cervix, crochet hooks, button hooks, chicken feathers.
And just with those herbal remedies, did any of them actually work?
Well, they thought it worked. And if it worked some of the time to reduce the number of pregnancies or to bring the period back, then it worked.
What were the first regulations that were actually brought in to restrict the use of some kind of these traditional methods? And when were they actually brought in?
The first laws regarding what we call abortion in the U.S. were really around these abortifacients, which are the methods of ingesting something, taking potions or herbs or liquids and swallowing them to try to induce a miscarriage or bring the menses back. And those were first passed in the 1820s and 1830s. They were really addressed at trying to suppress the sale of those kinds of products, and mostly talked about women and the fetus being killed in the process of trying to take these medications. They did not talk about abortions using instruments, and they were all post-quickening. So they were really more poison control measures. It's not until later in the century that abortion laws that we think of that covered everything from conception on, those weren't passed until the 1860s and 1870s.
When those laws criminalizing abortions were passed in the United States, they were initiated by two groups. Michelle Obermann is professor of law at Santa Clara University and the author of Her Body, Our Laws.
And surprisingly, what happened was that you had a coalition of medical doctors and religious leaders who together supported criminalizing abortion for the religious leaders because of a sense that there was something wrong in the deliberate intervention with what they saw to be a developing life. For doctors, because they viewed the lay midwives as a threat to their would-be monopoly. Really, until the early 20th century, doctors weren't involved in childbirth. Women had their babies at home with the help of midwives, and midwives also had the necessary experience and knowledge to help women end unwanted pregnancies. So it was kind of a power grab for doctors at the state legislative level to jump on board with the criminalization of abortion. So in those early decades, the laws were, when they were enforced almost exclusively against the person who provided the abortion rather than against the pregnant person.
Abortion had become more visible, more commercially visible. There were actually clinics. There was a lot of advertising in newspapers by providers in the 1840s and the 1850s. There was also a fall in the birth rate that was fairly visible, and doctors were certainly convinced that abortion was part of the reason. And they are seeing that there's a specific group of women who are having abortions, and they are married, middle class, and Protestant women. And prior to this period, they had thought that it was mostly unwed women who were desperate, who were trying to cover up their, quote, disgrace. And, you know, they could accept that and have some compassion for it. But when they start seeing that it's married women going to these commercial practitioners, this really gets the ire up of these specific group of physicians. And what they talk about is these married Protestant women are not doing their duty of having children. And if they don't, are we going to have a population of British Anglo-Saxon Protestants, or is it going to be populated by immigrants and Catholics? And so they really use that argument to appeal to legislators. And the other part for these doctors is they are in competition with irregular physicians and midwives, and they're partly using this crusade to pass the laws to strengthen their own organization and professionalize. So those things really come together.
And the kind of laws that they were pushing for, what were they, and how quickly did various states adopt anti-abortion legislation?
So these measures that pass in the 1860s and 70s that are pushed by the physicians, they are really different because at any point from conception on is now called an abortion and is made against the law to perform an abortion, to assist an abortion, to provide information, to advertise. Anything involved is now called an abortion and is against the law, not just post-quickening. And it was really every state, all of the states by 1880 had criminalized abortion from conception on, and then the laws stayed the same for a century.
The question that you asked about how abortion crimes got enforced and how regularly they got enforced ends up being a pretty interesting one. Abortion's a pretty hard crime to detect. As crimes go, it is as secretive and as private a crime as one can imagine. And so the only way in which a local prosecutor inclined to enforce abortion laws would find out about an abortion is usually when something went wrong. So you had a woman who was hospitalized with complications from an illegal abortion, or you had a woman who died from an illegal abortion, and that might lead to a criminal investigation. They tended to come in spates, and then there'd be almost no prosecution. So it would be almost like a prosecutor got really excited about or agitated about abortion and chose to do everything within his power to enforce the law. There might have been a couple of prosecutions, and then it would kind of go away, in part because it takes a lot of resources. They're hard to prosecute, they're hard to catch, hard to prosecute, in part because juries tend to be pretty loath to convict when faced with these cases.
But that changed in the 1930s and 40s when authorities began cracking down on all abortion providers, the good, the bad, and the indifferent.
Part of what happened was, some in the 30s, but really in the 1940s and on, the law enforcement kind of changed and started going after the really excellent practitioners. There were practitioners who had opened clinics with business cards and everybody knew where they were, who had been practicing for 10, 20 years. And they started going after those people, raiding those clinics, deliberately going in, trying to capture them when there were women on the table in the middle of a procedure with the doctor, catch them in the middle of an operation and all the patients there, capture all of them, the nurses, and take all the patient records. So that really changes the landscape. These very good practitioners are being put in the slammer so that they're not there anymore. And you have all kinds of people kind of go into the business because the demand is still there, the need is still there. And at the same time, there's greater concern within hospitals because abortion, along with all medical care, is going into hospitals. Doctors in hospitals, the very doctors who provide legal therapeutic abortions, create therapeutic abortion committees, review boards, and those review boards end up restricting the number of legal abortions. So you have both things happening in the 50s and 60s. You have this squeeze on the illegal side, and on the legal side, where doctors do these legal abortions in hospitals, they're doing fewer and fewer of them. So that means hard to get, expensive, probably pushing more women to do self-induced abortions, pushing some women to fly out of the country, and also pushing them into the hands of people who are not safe.
The ability to secure a safe abortion in America prior to Roe v. Wade depended upon the quality of your network and the amount of money you had. So if you had a good network, in other words, people who knew where to send you, and you had the money, you could get somewhere to have a safe abortion. For women who were living in, just say, the Deep South or in places where you didn't necessarily have a quality medically trained doctor, you might need to get yourself to a state like New York or California, where laws against abortion softened and then liberalized in the 1970s before the Supreme Court decided Roe v. Wade. And really, the same thing has been true throughout history. If you have the money, you can have a safer procedure. It doesn't mean it will be safe. And surely there were plenty of middle-class women and wealthy women who died from their illegal abortions. The estimates vary, but in the years immediately prior to Roe, some estimate that as many as 5,000 women a year died from illegal abortions. But again, the more money you had, the less likely it was that your illegal abortion would also be a terribly unsafe abortion.
But pro-life groups question how many women died in the 1950s and 60s from illegal abortions. Teresa Collette is a professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law.
I think, in fact, that was what the media covered. And in fact, at the close of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America in 1960, they recognized that in 1957, there were only 260 deaths in the whole country attributed to abortions of any kind. Now, again, this was because many of the deaths related to what were illegal abortions in the 40s and the 30s and the 20s were because we didn't have antibiotics. And we certainly weren't able to treat complications in the same way we were. So if you look at when antibiotics became available in a widespread basis through the healthcare system, then all of a sudden deaths related to abortion declined dramatically. It's why abortion providers today provide a prophylactic regime of antibiotics when a woman has had an abortion.
With antibiotics, maternal mortality finally dropped in the U.S. and around the world with antibiotics. That's when you really see the change, where illegal abortion was responsible for maybe 15% of maternal mortality at the start of the 20th century. By the end, it's responsible for maybe 45% of maternal mortality. But by the 1950s and 1960s in the U.S., there are people doing their own abortions, self-induced abortions. There's incompetent abortions, and they know how to do it safely, but you don't have access so that you have these really high rates. But other things that they can see, in addition to people dying, is there's really high morbidity and problems related to abortion because it's illegal. So there were thousands of women pouring into the emergency rooms around the country. And I can just give you a few numbers, which just hints at what the results are when it's illegal. Los Angeles County Hospital in the 1950s had 2,000 cases a year coming in for emergency care due to abortions. DC General had 20 every single day. Cook County Hospital had, in 1939, over 1,000 women coming in every year with abortion-related complications. And by the early 1960s, almost 5,000 every year. And they had entire wards called septic abortion wards that were devoted to women who are coming in with abortion complications. And, you know, we don't have those anymore in our hospitals in the U.S. We do not have a ward called septic abortion wards where we expect several thousand women coming in every single year. That went away, totally went away, following the legalization of abortion.
You're with Rear Vision here on RN. I'm Annabelle Quince. By the end of the 1960s, several states began liberalizing their abortion laws. In 1967, Colorado became the first state to decriminalize abortion in cases of rape, incest, or where the woman's life was in danger. Similar laws were passed in California, Oregon, and North Carolina. In 1970, Hawaii became the first state to legalize abortion on request, and New York soon followed. So where did the push for decriminalization come from, and how did that lead to Roe v. Wade?
There were a number of folks who were troubled by what was happening in the world of illegal abortion, who were troubled by the impact of abortion bans on poor women, who were troubled by the number of women showing up bleeding and with life-threatening infections in hospitals. And so a coalition of folks began to push for the reform of abortion laws, feminists, doctors, the same profession really that had pushed to ban abortion 100 years earlier, were really the leaders of the push to liberalize abortion laws in mid-20th century and into the 1960s and 70s in this country. The way that Roe versus Wade came to be was that one of these lawyers, a lawyer named Sarah Weddington, was working in Texas, which had a very restrictive abortion law at the time. I think there was only an exception to save a mother's life. And so when Jane Roe sought help to end an unwanted pregnancy, the woman from whom she sought help connected her with Sarah Weddington, who then brought a straight head-on challenge to the Texas statute in the state of Texas, but suing, claiming that the statute in Texas violated Jane Roe's constitutional right to privacy. And at the time, the right to privacy had been newly consecrated, if you will, by the Supreme Court in a decision that overturned laws banning contraception. So up until 1965, a state could ban the use of contraception under the grounds that it somehow violated the state's sensibilities of around morality. And in 1965, a challenge successfully overturned those laws on the grounds that individuals have a right to privacy. So Sarah Weddington, Jane Roe's lawyer, took that right to privacy and claimed that the state shouldn't be able to force a woman to carry an unwanted pregnancy, because if she has the right to privacy in order to prevent pregnancy by using contraception, so too she should have the right to privacy to end an unwanted pregnancy. Texas found against Jane Roe, and so Sarah Weddington appealed the case up to the Supreme Court.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government. Thus, the anti-abortion laws of 46 states were rendered unconstitutional.
And the country was just stunned in the wake of Roe v. Wade to realize how divided we really were on abortion. The 7-2 decision did not really give any inkling of the controversy that has ensnared us for the decades since then.
According to those who opposed the Roe decision, it was the imposition of decriminalization on the states which led to the controversy, by squashing the genuine debate that had been occurring at the state level before 1973.
We were seeing in the 1960s, and in 1970 in particular, a very robust debate about whether or not we should retain states' laws on this. And the various groups like the American Law Institute and the Uniform Laws Commission and various physicians groups were taking positions trying to lead the public to these conclusions that the laws ought to be liberalized. But a vast majority of states that actually had legislation introduced to them, and states that had referendums, were much less enthusiastic about these sorts of reforms and repeal. There appeared to be that the public surveys at that time clearly reflected that people were sympathetic to the idea that abortion ought to be available more broadly than it was in certain states like Texas. But beyond that, they were not particularly sympathetic to the idea that it ought to be available on the basis of the economic status of the woman. And they didn't agree that it ought to be just generally abortion on demand.
The first thing that happened is that every state that had a law making abortion illegal, those laws were suddenly suspended. So now you can't enforce the laws against it, but then what's the infrastructure in place by which a woman can have an abortion? And the first problem that's encountered is the problem of, well, who's trained to provide them? And there weren't doctors trained to provide abortions, but there were doctors who had been treating miscarriage, and the process wasn't entirely different. But instead of mainstream doctors who had been providing miscarriage management suddenly becoming also abortion providers, an odd thing happened, which is that a group of doctors elected to specialize in the provision of abortion care. And women, for reasons that had to do, I think, with the feminist health movement, joined with those doctors who became specialists. And you saw the birth of abortion clinics around the country. And they pretty quickly scaled up to be able to meet the needs of folks who wanted to end their pregnancies legally. The other problem with access, though, involves money, because abortions cost money. And the challenge that came right on the heels of Roe was a challenge relating to whether women who were poor, whether those women should be able to use state funding, Medicaid funding, to pay for their abortions. If abortion is standard health care, then your health insurance should cover it the same way that it would cover if you broke your arm. But if it's something elective, like maybe a nose job would be elective, well, then that should be out of pocket. So the first big conflict we saw after the Supreme Court made abortion legal was a question about whether states should be forced to pay for it. And that battle was lost for poor women, and poor women from 1977 forward had to pay for abortions in most states in my country out of their own pockets, which means that while it's legal, it's not necessarily accessible for the poorest Americans.
You will find more pregnancy assistance centers in this country than you do abortion clinics. There is a whole, and frankly, the larger group of people involved in the pro-life movement are people who undertook the challenge to provide women who find themselves in very difficult situations with the resources they need to bring that child to term and to parent that child in the early stages, or to assist them with placing that child with a very good adoptive family. And then, in addition to that, in responding directly to the failure of law to protect these unborn children or the fetus, they have both tried to pass legislation that recognized the humanity of the unborn. And then you've seen the restrictions where Roe versus Wade and its companion case of Doe versus Bolton have gone beyond what many of us would consider the bounds of common sense. If you have a 15-year-old child who is pregnant, who is trying to determine what the best way to respond to this pregnancy is, to exclude the parents is bizarre. And so you have seen efforts to pass parental consent statutes. There has been a strategy of regulating both to protect the child, but also to protect the woman from having her fears played upon by providers who are unwilling to help her consider alternatives in responding to this pregnancy.
For the past 20 years, there's been a flurry of activity in state legislatures around abortion, and none of these laws actually gets enacted. Each of the laws that gets passed that would curtail a woman's legal right to end her pregnancy is immediately suspended because it would be in conflict with a woman's constitutional right. So what's happening at the state level is folks who are elected by a pro-life constituency demonstrate their fidelity to that agenda by passing laws that have a symbolic value only. At least the most dramatic of the laws that we're seeing now, the laws that say abortion shall be illegal from the moment that you can hear a heartbeat. The other thing, though, that's happened is that very sophisticated lawyers within the anti-abortion movement have managed to create laws that do whittle away at how one accesses legal abortion. They've put into place regulations on who can provide an abortion, on where they provide an abortion, and they've also put into place regulations around when and how a woman accesses it. So does there need to be a waiting period? Does she need to notify or get the consent of her parents if she's under the age of 18? Where and under what conditions could she have a termination after the point of fetal viability? Those sorts of regulations have been pretty aggressively pushed in this century. There were some of them happening in the 1990s, but nothing like the raft of laws that we're seeing passed at the state level in this century.
Alabama's governor has signed a bill banning nearly all abortions in the state, even in cases of rape or incest. It sets up a fierce legal battle that anti-abortion campaigners are hoping will lead to the Supreme Court.
So are we seeing the beginning of the end of Roe v. Wade?
I do, because the reality is in many states like mine, Minnesota and California and Florida, in a number of other states, it would have zero impact. There are multiple states where you have a state constitutional interpretation that abortion is constitutionally protected. The state of Washington, it was done by a public referenda. I can see a time where the court will return the issue of abortion to the states. Does that mean that we will see 30 plus states prohibit abortion except for the life of the mother, the situation prior to Roe v. Wade? I would be deeply surprised if that were the case. The voters tend to think that abortion should be available for victims of rape. They tend to believe abortion should be available where the woman's life is in danger, as it was prior to Roe in every state in the union. They tend to think that it should be available where there are fetal abnormalities that are incompatible with life. In many instances, they tend to think it should be available in the first 8 to 12 weeks of pregnancy. Is that what people like myself, who think every abortion ends the life of an unborn child, would want? No. Is that what a majority of Americans probably want? Yes.
We're already seeing the chipping away of one's ability to access a legal abortion by making it more expensive and more difficult to access abortion. And with the Supreme Court that is seemingly more amenable to states' desires to limit abortion in the states, we'll very likely just continue to see that trend intensify. You'll see a Supreme Court that's willing to say, you know, like, let the states do what they want to restrict this procedure.
Michelle Obermann, Professor of Law at Santa Clara University. My other guests, Teresa Collette, Professor of Law at the University of St. Thomas, and Leslie Regan, Professor of History at the University of Illinois. The sound engineer is Simon Branthwaite. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.